I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. First, in our ongoing series of conversations with candidates for governor in this fall's election, we talk to Tim Herbst of Trumbull. And reporter Martha Shanahan stops to talk about how the growing acceptance of marijuana as a recreational and medical drug is affecting anti-drug education programs at local schools.
Let's start off by you introducing yourself, a little bit of your background, and what pulled you into the race for governor.
Well, my name's Tim Herbst. I'm from Trumbull, Connecticut, where I had the honor and privilege these last 8 years to be the first selectman of Trumbull, elected when I was 29 years old. I'm a Trumbull native. I'm the son of public school teachers, public educators. I graduated from Trumbull High School in 1998, and then I went to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, where I graduated with honors in 2002 with a degree in political science, and I had the privilege of being the president of the student body my senior year. And then I went on to law school. I graduated from Pace University School of Law in 2007, where I was a member of the Pace Environmental Law Review. I began my career in public service at the age of 19 years old, when I was elected to an open seat on the Trumbull Planning and Zoning Commission, re-elected in 2005 at the age of 25, when I became the chairman, where I served for 4 years upon my election as first selectman. And I just recently stepped down after 8 years to go all in to try to become the 89th governor of the state of Connecticut.
And why now? I mean, obviously the fiscal problems, the deficits are pretty sizable in Connecticut. What's your plan to attack that?
If ever there was a time to send proven reformers and Hartford outsiders to the Gold Dome to shake things up, it's now. My plan is rooted in common sense, accountability, fairness, and results. I believe leaders lead by example. I'm the only candidate in this race that has taken a lead by example pledge. I'm the only candidate running for governor in either party that has refused donations from Hartford lobbyists. I'm the only candidate in either party to say that if I'm elected governor, I will refuse a pension from the state of Connecticut. And I will insist that all of my agency heads and cabinet members do the same. I believe it's important for leaders to lead by example. So during the course of this campaign, I'm going to talk about pension and benefit reform, tax reform, regulatory and spending reform, infrastructure reform, the things that are directly impacting people's lives here in Connecticut. And I should be so bold as to say they're adversely harming people's lives here in the state of Connecticut.
So specifically, the labor contract, which is going through 2027, I believe. Mm-hmm. How would you address that? That's such a big part of the issue.
Well, if you saw that party line vote that happened in approving it, it was obvious that organized labor had a tremendous influence on the Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate in getting them to pass that. I really believe the CBAC agreement is a noose around the neck of the state of Connecticut. I don't think it was right that a Republican governor by the name of John Rowland agreed to a 20-year agreement. And I don't think it was right that a Democratic governor by the name of Dan Malloy agreed to a 10-year extension. The reason why the state has been mired in perpetual deficit is because these unfunded liabilities, $71 billion between pensions and retiree health care, continue to consume more and more of our state budget. The fixed costs, salaries, benefits, debt service, pension contributions, continue to take up more and more of the state budget. And as that continues to happen, what we're seeing is the things that directly impact people's lives are being put on the chopping block. You've seen it in Greater New London with proposed reductions to ECS funding for local towns and cities. I saw the proposed cuts for Groton last year, and they were shocking, alarming. Cuts to municipal aid for road improvements and infrastructure. Cuts to social services and programs that affect the mentally infirm and the elderly. We can't keep doing this. So if we don't address this 800-pound gorilla in the room, this is going to continue to happen in the state of Connecticut. We will continue to have budget deficits. We will continue to cut the programs that directly impact people's lives unless and until we get serious about saying, you know what? We don't represent the leaders of organized labor. We represent the citizens and taxpayers of the state of Connecticut. We are supposed to be their advocate. And until we start thinking like that, we're not going to fix this problem.
So let's pull back a little bit and talk about how you think the divisiveness in Washington will affect the upcoming elections here in Connecticut, if at all, if you think it does, and maybe more specifically the Trump administration, how it would affect the elections in the state, and maybe more specifically how it would affect your campaign.
Well, you know, people like to talk about the divisiveness and dysfunction in Washington. I think we have plenty of our own divisiveness and dysfunction in Hartford. And people like to talk about Donald Trump, and the Democrats are going to try to make this election about Trump. Here's the deal. I've said it before, and I'm going to keep saying it. The most unpopular person in Connecticut is not Donald Trump. The most unpopular person in Connecticut is Dan Malloy. That's a fact. And what's pretty pathetic is that he has a 23% job approval rating in what is a reliably blue state. So that means a significant percentage of Democrats are very displeased with his job performance. So I'm going to talk to those disenfranchised Democrats, independents, and reform-minded Republicans, and put together a broad coalition of people that realize that this election is about the future of our state. It's about electing the 89th governor of Connecticut, not the 89th representative to go to Washington. It's about focusing on the things that matter to people here in Connecticut. So, you know what, they're going to try to take this campaign in the gutter, and we're already starting to see them engaging in divisive identity politics in the name of winning an election. When they do that, we're going to set the record straight. This election's about the state of Connecticut, and this election is not a referendum on Donald Trump. It is a referendum on Dan Malloy's 8 years of abject failure, and it is a referendum on 40 years of one-party rule in the legislature that has destroyed the state of Connecticut. That's what this election is about.
Along those lines, what do you think the Republican Party needs to do to attract so many of those? I mean, it's more than half of the registered voters in Connecticut are registered as independent voters. What do you think needs to be done to reach them?
I think we need to tell people what we're going to do to fix the state. You know, the last two elections, we did a very good job of telling people why Dan Malloy was not a good governor. That'll get you 48 or 49%. But if you're going to get 50.1%, you need to articulate a vision of where you're going to lead the state. So I think we need to speak to people's concerns with concrete plans and solutions as to how we're going to fix the state's finances, have a truly balanced budget, reduce the tax burden in this state, reduce the regulatory environment, make Connecticut more competitive for businesses, invest in our infrastructure, which means better economic development that attracts businesses and by extension people to our state. And here's the other thing that I think I'm uniquely positioned to do by virtue of my age. I am the youngest person currently running for governor. I'm 37 years old. I am going to, in my opinion, be able to speak in a way, I think, better to millennials that are very down on Connecticut, that are apathetic to participating in the political process, that have high student loans, lack of jobs, and wonder whether tomorrow is going to be better than today and whether there is a future for them in Connecticut. I think I can speak to their concerns better than any other candidate because I share those concerns. And during the course of this campaign, I've talked about how we cannot keep sending politicians to Hartford that are focused on the next election. We must send leaders to Hartford that are focused on the next generation. And I talk about the next generation a lot because I wonder if 30 years from now, when I'm old and gray, we'll be able to look back on this moment and this time and say, in 2018, we took a stand and we did what needed to be done to not only win an election, but restore the promise of Connecticut and make sure that it lives up to the reality of Connecticut.
So wrapping it up, any specific message to our region, to the southeastern Connecticut region for voters? What do you have to offer them? Why should they go out and vote for you?
Southeastern Connecticut will have no greater advocate in the governor's office than Tim Herbst. This area of the state's important to me. My father was born and raised in the 2nd Congressional District in Clinton, which is a little down the road. I understand the needs of the 2nd District better than most candidates because I've talked to those leaders at the local level and hearing their concerns about making sure that EB is protected, that we protect these jobs and protect the defense industry here in southeastern Connecticut. I understand the importance of the casino industry in eastern Connecticut and the jobs that it creates. I understand that the 2nd District has been ignored for far too long. And the economic recovery, if you could call it one, in this state, I don't think we've had much of one, But the second district has lagged behind the rest of the state because I believe the second district has been neglected. I am not going to be the governor that neglects the second district. And I think if you look at the people that have endorsed me from the second district, from Eastern Connecticut, they've endorsed me, state reps and senators, because they recognize my commitment to the people of Southeastern Connecticut and the second congressional district.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I started thinking about this story about kids and sort of how they think about marijuana and how the drug prevention experts are trying to get them to think about it and as a sort of unsafe activity. I met with a woman named Carolyn Wilson who runs a program called GASP. And they mostly do work with the community, and then they also work at Fitch High School. And she sort of mentioned when I met with her a little while ago that they were specifically focusing on trying to, they had a grant specifically focusing on educating kids about marijuana and about, you know, trying to educate them about using it. You know, avoiding it and not using it as a, you know, not abusing it as a substance. And we're obviously having some problems getting that message across, partially because it's a pretty well saturated thing in pop culture. I mean, there's television shows that are literally all just about, you know, the consumption of marijuana. Mm-hmm. You kind of can't look anywhere, especially I think in some of the music and the TV and movies that kids are consuming these days without, you know, having sort of marijuana be sort of normalized in those. And that's been something that's going on for a while, but I think it's kind of, it's picked up steam, especially because it's now legal in multiple states. In Connecticut, it's the recreational marijuana isn't legal, but medical marijuana is. So, you know, it's kind of becoming part of the culture and part of the, you know, it's kind of in the air, so to speak. no pun intended. And they look at those, you know, the kids look at those things and they say, well, if everything around me is telling me that it's okay, the law is telling me, you know, that it's okay, and the movies are telling, and music and everything is telling me that it's okay, then why, like, why shouldn't I smoke weed? Or, and it's not just smoking weed, it's all kinds of combinations of ways that you can get cannabis into your body, which is, you know, stuff that, like, I can't even imagine. It comes in wax form, in oil form. You can vape it in a vape pen.
You can drink it. Right?
Apparently, I don't know. Yeah, you infuse can. I mean, you can it. At least
you
eat
can
it.
Infuse your drink.
Right.
So, going back a little bit about how the recreational use of marijuana is becoming legal in more and more states. None of these states allow for recreational use of marijuana by minors.
That's the thing that I talked to,
18 or under.
That's the thing that and I think different states have different rules about the ages, but that's something that I talked to all these folks about who are trying to reach out to kids. You know, even if they're not necessarily resigned, they're, you know, opposed to it being legalized, you know, in Connecticut.
So legalized, period. These groups are opposed to the legalization of recreational use, right?
Well, the various organizations don't necessarily have a policy position on it. You know, they're not going out there like advocating against it necessarily. There are other groups that do that. But they are, they're a little bit resigned to the fact that, you know, there's been a couple of polls out that show that, like, most people in Connecticut favor legalizing it. The money argument is also a hard one to have, because a lot of what what proponents of legalizing it in Connecticut at least are saying is, you know, we have this budget crisis. We state doesn't have any money. We need to find as many ways of raising right. revenue as we can. And this and taxing marijuana is one way of doing that. And they're looking at states like Colorado that right. where it's been legal for a while now and saying, look at all this revenue that they've been able to raise. Massachusetts has not, they haven't, they're in the process of rolling out their.
They do have a law that allows for recreational use. They just haven't implemented it.
Right, exactly.
Right. And Rhode Island is tossing around ideas.
Yeah.
Similar ideas.
Yeah. So they're a little bit resigned to the fact that there are, you know, there's, it's probably going to happen eventually, or it's, you know, there's a lot of impetus to make it happen. And in that case, they are going to have to think about, so then what is their role as drug prevention, you know, educators? And they're still not going to want kids to be consuming any drugs,
right.
including marijuana. And
right.
it still would not, I mean, any law legalizing it would not include minors
right.
in that. I mean, so it's this, it would be sort of the same as alcohol, which they also are, you know, there's programs focusing on getting kids to not consume alcohol, or any other, you know, prescription drugs, which are legal, you know, which are fine
right.
under the law, but also like 16-year-olds should not be,
right.
you know, abusing Vicodin, for example.
But it seems like the tactics would be different if you accept the fact that some substance is legal once you turn 18, that your tactics for education for minors would be different than your program against heroin, for instance.
Yeah.
That's never going to be legal. So your kind of educational tactics would be different.
Right.
Similar to how they are different when you try to inform kids that drinking before they're of age is
yeah.
dangerous. And
yeah, and they drew a lot of parallels between marijuana and alcohol, you know, in saying that, like, yeah, I mean, alcohol is everywhere. It's legal. The adults in your life are probably drinking it. But your brain is not an adult
right.
brain. You don't have the facilities to do this responsibly or in a healthy way as a, you know, as a kid. And there are also like safe ways of doing it and also, you know, not safe ways of doing it. Like if you are going to drink or if you are going to consume marijuana in some ways, there's a scale of healthiness of ways that you could go about doing that. Their job isn't going to go away,
right.
basically.
Right.
It might move, you know, they might have to change their tactics a little bit,
right.
but I think that the science that, you know, any drug, including alcohol, including marijuana, is bad for
kids, a
developing brain.
Right.
Is not going to go away. So,
have you spoken? Have you had an opportunity to speak to kids?
Not yet. I might by the time.
Is it difficult to find someone?
It's hard because they, you know, they're reluctant to.
The parents must be.
Especially, I mean, so it's been pretty easy to me to try to find kids that, you know, are part of these anti-drug groups that are sort of, you know, have, you know, bought into the idea that they should be trying to get their friends to stop abusing drugs and that the drugs are bad for you. And, those are the kids that sort of get the praise and, you know, they get the adults telling them like, good for you. Like you're you're on the right
yeah.
side of this.
Yeah.
It's tricky because I don't have a lot of contacts in like teenagers, the groups of teenagers and groups of kids. If anyone out there has a teenager who smokes a lot of weed and wants to tell me about it, they're welcome to call me.
Thank you.
Thanks.